Today is Wednesday, March 22nd. We're going to be wrapping up the nervous system with a discussion of nerve impulse transmission. All right, so we left off talking about neurons in chapter 11. Let's pick up with page 93. About a third of the way down the page, let's talk about cells associated with nervous tissue. And there's two types. There's neurons and there's neuroglia. 93. Neurons are cells that conduct nerve impulses. That's one thing that makes them different from neuroglial cells. Neuroglial cells don't conduct nerve impulses. Okay, so neurons are special because they do conduct nerve impulses, but unfortunately they lose the ability to divide. So if you damage neurons, then the damage may be permanent, especially if you're beyond your middle teenage years. There's some plasticity with your nervous system up until your middle teenage years, and then after that it appears to be mostly set. And so if you're an adult and you damage those neurons, there's less likely of a chance for them to repair themselves. Those neurons are protected by neuroglia. Technically, the term neuroglia means nerve glue, and these neuroglial cells are meant to protect. They help insulate around those neurons and ensure that they can conduct their nerve impulses. Kind of cool thing here is those neuroglia don't lose the ability to divide, so most of them can repair themselves if they've been damaged. So it'd be great if we could harness that and then tell those neurons that have been damaged, okay, go ahead and divide if you've been damaged, like spinal cord damage, for instance. So let me take you through the three types of neurons. We've talked about this a little bit. Neurons can be either sensory, integration, or motor. And of course, sensory neurons carry information in what direction?
Towards
central. Good. So they're carrying information about the world inside and outside your body. And they're taking that information toward your brain and spinal cord for interpretation. You'll notice there's a various type of receptors there that pick up on that info. Interoceptors tell your brain and spinal cord about the inside body. What do proprioceptors tell your brain and spinal cord? Yeah, muscles and joints, and so where your body position is in space. You know, of course, you can close your eyes and know where your arms and legs are. That's the proprioceptor's job. And then we have exteroceptors, which tell our brain and spinal cord about the outside world. Temperature, for instance, or touch on our skin. So these receptors are going to be sensory neurons. They're like tattletales. They tell your brain and spinal cord when there's been changes in your environment. Okay, interneurons are found only in your central nervous system, and it is their job to communicate between incoming sensory and outgoing motor neurons. That blank there is only within the CNS, central nervous system.
Right. Is there a certain word out of the three that you're going to use, like the name?
I tend to use interneuron rather than association, or I definitely don't use integration. Interneuron tends to be the one I pick more. So interneurons are communicators. They're kind of like the middleman. They are found only in your CNS. It is their job to communicate between incoming sensory and outgoing motor neurons. So what's the function of a motor neuron? Good. It takes information from your central nervous system to your organs. So they carry out directions. They carry out, hey, you need to secrete sweat, or hey, this muscle needs to contract. So the types of directions that come from your central nervous system are transported in outgoing motor neurons. Brain and spinal cord, right? And you could call them collectively CNS. Neuroglia means nerve glue, and these are insulating and protecting cells. They don't divide, or they do divide rather, but they don't conduct nerve impulses. I'd like to take you through the list there. We're going to start off with the neuroglia in your central nervous system, and the first type is called a microglia. Technically, it means tiny glue. These are actually spider-like phagocytes, so they have lots of branching arms and legs, and by being phagocytes, what are they doing for a living? eating bacteria, eating debris. So anything that comes in contact with your central nervous system that may be potentially damaging may be eaten by these phagocytes. So we go from spider-like neuroglia to star-shaped neuroglia. And the astrocytes are star-shaped, they're branched, and they help to form something called our blood-brain barrier. I say that one three times fast. Okay, so the blood-brain barrier is something we'll talk about in a later chapter. It is a barrier to most items in the bloodstream, and these astrocytes actually form a pretty tight seal around the capillaries in your brain. That way, most items in your brain cannot get into your brain tissue. Another type of neuroglial cell in your CNS is called an oligodendrocyte. I know, what a name. Oligodendrocyte forms the myelin sheath, which is a protective wrapping around your neurons in your brain and spinal cord. When I talk about oligodendrocytes, I have a mental image of a half-used paper towel roll. Okay, so the paper towel roll basically is paper towels wrapped and wrapped and wrapped around and around, and the tube in the middle is where the neuron actually goes. So if you can see that, it literally looks like a toilet paper roll or a paper towel roll. It is a wrapping that goes around and around those cells, meant to be a protector and an insulator. Same concept works with cords. You know, all these electrical cords have a plastic wrapping on the outside to keep us from getting shocked. That's the kind of the same concept as an oligodendrocyte. All right, and then finally, the last of our CNS support cells is called an ependymal cell. This particular cell has cilia, and so it sweeps along and creates the cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, so we can abbreviate CSF for cerebrospinal fluid. This particular cell circulates CSF. So what I did for you in your course pack is I underlined some key terms. I'm hoping that will help you out when you're studying for the test on Monday. So for instance, oligodendrocyte, I would think myelin sheath. When I think about ependymal cells, I would think about cerebrospinal fluid circulation. So instead of trying to memorize a sentence or a description, I would look at those key terms as being a kind of a snapshot of what you want to remember about each of those neuroglia. 2S words, satellite and Schwann cells, are found in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, so 2S words, satellite and Schwann. They are both going to wrap and protect around those neurons in the peripheral nervous system. And keep in mind, those are cranial nerves and spinal nerves that serve your body. So these types of cells wrap and protect and form a myelin sheath. So the satellite cell specifically wraps and covers the cell body where the nucleus is housed. What do the Schwann cells wrap and cover? Yeah, they wrap and form a myelin sheath. They actually cover the axon, which is the longest part of that cell.
So it produces a myelin sheath, is the tube one?
Produces a myelin sheath, yep. Okay, bottom blank down there, myelin sheath. Yeah, just those two, the S word, satellite, and Schwann.
And it was all in the central nervous system?
Yeah, those four, they're four central nervous system.
So the satellite cells, it's not the same thing as what the oligodendrocyte and whatever?
It's location. Oligodendrocytes are brain and spinal cord, and satellite and Schwann are spinal nerves and cranial nerves. They do the same job, it's just the location. So let's talk about neuron structure. That is found over on page 94. Okay, so there's actually different types of neurons. We know there's sensory, we know there's motor, there's also interneurons. And then when you think about their structures, motor neurons are structured like the one you see here. you'll notice a typical cell body with a bunch of dendrites branching off. You'll notice a single long axon traveling away from the cell body. Not all neurons look like this. Some have a different structure, but this is a common form for a neuron. So we're going to use this as our basis for understanding how neurons are shaped and structured. Let me start you at the top there with the cell body. That cell body is the metabolic center for your cell, and it's around the nucleus. It contains organelles like mitochondria. And so we think of the cell body as being the metabolic center for your cell. Okay, so cell body is our first one there on the list. Our second item is called the axon. Go ahead.
Before we go forward, I have a question.
Sure.
I'm not sure what's the difference between motor and sensory?
Sensory is information going to your CNS. It's information about the world around you, inside you, your joints and muscles.
So would that be like a touch?
A touch.
And motor would be like an injury?
Motor is movement. Yes. Muscles move, glands secrete, but it's what your brain tells your muscles and glands to do. So it's coming from your CNS.
Oh.
Okay. Let's see. With an axon, the great and easy way to remember this is A for axon and A for away. This particular portion of the neuron carries nerve impulses away from the cell body. You'll notice in this picture, it's kind of hard to see with the light shining there, but there is, in fact, a myelin sheath around that axon, and if we're talking about a sheath of Schwann cells, that tells me we're looking at a cell in the peripheral nervous system, not the central nervous system. Okay, so that sheath there is meant to speed up nerve impulse transmission. It actually makes the nerve impulse hop, skip, and jump from node of Ronvier to the next node of Ronvier, and we're going to talk about that term as well. Okay, so you'll notice that axons there can usually be about one per nerve cell. There's not more than one in most cases. And in some cases, those neurons may be extremely long. This one shows a neuron in the leg with a really long axon. And if you think about nerve damage in the leg, that can affect everything beyond that point. So, you know, sciatic nerve, for instance, runs through literally your butt cheek and all the way down to your heel and into your foot. So the damage that may occur up at your butt can ultimately affect what's happening down at your heel. You may have, say, numbness in your leg at that point, but it's really important to consider that we've got maybe 3 feet of axon in some of those really long neurons. Okay, so when we finally get to the end of our axon, let's see, let me get you a different picture there. This is probably the best one to look at. When we run out of axon, we terminate with these little branched endings called axon terminals. And these axon terminals are familiar because we've talked about their role in releasing what?
ACH.
ACH, good. And what is ACH?
Acetylcholine.
Acetylcholine, and its job is to be a?
Is attached to the sodium channel.
Good, attaches to sodium channels, it binds to them and opens them up. So it's a chemical communicator, it's a neurotransmitter, and it excites neighboring muscle cells. So that's what those axon terminals release, is some form of neurotransmitter. Okay, so the blank there, by the way, is for the term neurotransmitter under the function. So far, we've talked about the cell body, which is the hub of activity in your neuron. We've talked about the axon, which carries information away from your cell body. Well, the information in your neuron travels in one direction only. And the next portion there, the dendrites, pick up on that information. So around your cell body, you have all these branched pieces sticking out, and those are the dendrites looking for incoming information. That set of dendrites will always funnel information toward your cell body. Let me emphasize that the axon always carries information away from your cell body. Okay, dendrites carry info to your cell body, axons carry info away from. So if you use your imagination, what you're looking at here kind of looks like a tree. You know, a typical tree has a bunch of branches up top, that's your dendrites. Here's the long tree trunk, that's your axon. Tree trunks have bark on them. That's the myelin sheath wrapping and protecting. And then trees should have roots, and those, of course, are the axon terminals. So the word dend as a prefix means like tree or branching, and so it kind of is reminiscent of a tree and its shape. I'd like to spend just a moment going in more detail with you about the myelin sheath. That myelin sheath is meant to wrap and insulate and protect your axon terminals. So, like we were talking earlier, that myelin sheath can be formed by two different types of cells. If we're talking about a myelin sheath in your central nervous system, it's formed by what type of neuroglial cell? What type of neuroglial cell forms the myelin sheath in your CNS?
That would be the oligodendrocyte something.
That's it, oligodendrocyte. Okay, and in the peripheral nervous system, it's formed by?
Schwann
cells. Good, just want to clarify, there's two different cells that do the very same job in wrapping and forming that myelin sheath. Okay, so your blank there, it says blank forms the myelin sheath around nerve fibers in your PNS. S1 cells, good. Okay, that blank there with the letter E beside it is Schwann cells. Those cells do wrap like a roll of toilet paper or a paper towel roll around and around the axon. The job is to insulate and protect that axon, and so it's kind of a fatty protein-rich covering. So if you have damage to the myelin sheath, at least you still have a protected neuron and axon up underneath. You'll notice in this picture that there are gaps of space between adjacent myelin sheaths. These Schwann cells wrap, and then there's a tiny bit of space where they don't touch the next myelin sheath. Those little gaps of space between those cells are called nodes of Ranvier. Okay, that's your next blank, nodes of Ranvier. And they're important because they help to speed up nerve impulse transmission. Instead of a nerve impulse having to travel down the entire length of the axon, it only hops, skips, and jumps from one node to the next node. So when you're looking at a picture like this, that myelin sheath makes your axon look white. In fact, it is called white matter. And so we say that in white matter, we experience a faster nerve impulse transmission because the nerve impulse only has to hop, skip, and jump down from one node to the next node. We're going to talk about this word later today, but I'll go ahead and mention it now. We call this hop, skip, and jump action saltatory conduction. So it literally allows the nerve impulse to hop, skip, and jump from one exposed node to the next node. White matter has the fastest nerve impulses. Gray matter is slower. Gray matter doesn't have myelin sheaths. Okay, so white matter has the fastest nerve impulses. It is called saltatory conduction when a nerve impulse hops, skips, and jumps from one node of Ranvier to the next. Just a little history on these myelin sheaths. If you have damage to them, especially in the central nervous system, we call that disorder multiple sclerosis. Sclerosis means the hardening of those myelin sheaths, and in the case where the myelin sheath becomes hardened, that nerve impulse can no longer hop, skip, and jump. So you'll notice in this picture, the nerve impulse seems to go awry. It's just like taking an electrical cable, cutting the cord a little bit, and then if you plug it in for electricity, you touch that cord where you've cut it, and you now can get shocked. And that's the same concept here. If you happen to damage the myelin sheath, you'll notice that nerve impulse doesn't go where it's supposed to. It actually may go in other directions. This is why people with multiple sclerosis may experience numbness, tingling, and it migrates. One day they may have numbness in one area. A few weeks later, it may migrate to another area. I had a student in class several years ago. She was in the nursing program, and she was very stressed out. She put a lot of pressure on herself to do A work in all of her classes, and she had experienced some strange symptoms. For instance, she had a numb spot on her belly for about 3 weeks, and then it went away. And so she wrote it off as saying, I probably just sat funny, and I probably pinched the nerve, and it's all okay. Well, then she had a numb spot running down her leg. She thought the same thing. I probably just sat funny. I probably pinched a nerve. It's no problem. It's not a big deal. She didn't really start to take it seriously and connect the dots until she had problems seeing, because this can also affect the optic nerves traveling back into the brain. And then she realized there's more to this than just me sitting funny and pinching a nerve. So nowadays, there's not a tremendous amount they can do for multiple sclerosis. They can administer vitamin B12 shots, which seems to help, and stress management can also help to reduce the symptoms of MS. But ultimately, if we're affecting neurons in the brain, then we're ultimately affecting the ability to conduct nerve impulses, and that's the end result here, is we may see weakness and paralysis because of this. They believe that it is stress-triggered in some people. She may have had a predisposition to it. It's not that she was just normal and healthy and nothing was wrong. She might have had a genetic component maybe that produced a weakness to it, and all it required was an environmental stimulus like stress to turn on that gene. So it does affect women more than men. About 75% of the population that has MS are female. It's not commonly something that affects males, so if you're female and you know someone in your family that has it, it's worth watching your stress levels, because they're not entirely certain of the relationship here among familial, you know, family members and, you know, stress. Yeah. You can actually see the plaques here that form. You know, when those myelin sheaths get damaged, they can harden, and they can actually form scar tissue in the brain. And you might recall that scar tissue is mostly made of what type of fiber?
Collagen.
Collagen, yeah. So that's unfortunate, because no longer do we have an active site where neurons can conduct impulses if you've got scar tissue set up like there. All right. How about questions so far? Any questions on the parts of your neuron? Yeah. From what I understand, it's a tightening of the sheath around the nerve, and so it kind of grips on that nerve and narrows the passageway or the tunnel through which that nerve and the wrist passes through. I don't believe it's MS related. I just believe it's a narrowing of that tunnel.
The reason why I ask is because my husband was diagnosed with ulnar tunnel syndrome, and I said it's basically the same thing as carpal tunnel.
Okay.
I've never heard of it.
I had not heard of that one either.
And they have to go in.
Oh, awful. That's got to be terribly painful.
And he has the, where he grips open, he'll drop it because of the numbness and the tingling.
Right.
And they told him he needed to sleep like this, that they needed to get him some splints.
Yeah.
But that's not going
to
work.
Now, who's going to sleep like that?
Well, he's claustrophobic, so that's just not going to work.
I understand that, yeah. From what I understand, it's the tunnel through which those nerves pass becomes constricted. That seems to be the cause. I wish him luck with that.
Thank you.
Let's see. Pages 95, 96, 97, and 98 are the same story we've been through. I'm just going to add a little detail for you. And then I want to let you know that pages 99 through 101 are practice. So once we go through that together, then you've got three more practice pages that you can go back and work on. So I think that you're going to find this is a complete rerun of where we've been before. Instead of talking how we excite nerves to contract, we're going to talk about how we excite neighboring neurons. So this is nerve impulse transmission, and it's a process of sending an action potential from one neuron to another neuron. So we're going to walk through this. It's the same concept we covered back with muscles. The first thing I need to mention to you is this. Nerve impulses always travel in one direction only. They're like having a telephone that only makes calls out and never makes calls in. So the nerve impulse always travels from the dendrites to the cell body to where? To the axon, and finally to the axon terminals. Then we release a neurotransmitter, right? And then like acetylcholine, okay? And then so we travel across into a neighboring cell. We start it over from dendrites to cell body to axon terminals. And so we just keep sending this nerve impulse down the length of our neurons until we get to our final destination, which may in fact be a muscle cell. So, you know, this is one reason why we encourage you all to study often and frequently before a test and not to wait till the last minute. And it's because you can make new dendrite connections, but it takes time. So if you look at the material the night before the test, and that's the first time you look at it, those dendrites will start to make these little buds. They look like seedlings, don't they? And they don't necessarily connect to a new neuron. But if you look at the test material 2 weeks ahead of time, and every night before you take the test, then those little dendrite buds will actually make connections to new neurons, and now you've learned the material. And if you consistently review that material, those dendrite connections will stay in place, and you'll keep the material for long term. But if you don't use the material, you've heard the old saying, if you don't use it, you'll lose it, then these dendrite buds will actually be trimmed off, shaved off, and no longer used. So then you forget the material that you've learned. So kind of an interesting concept. I thought it would be relevant since we're now in the midst of talking about sending nerve impulses down the length of an axon and using those dendrites. Okay, so let me start you off on page 95. We're going to talk about what it means for a neuron to stay at rest. We call this resting membrane potential. All right, so at the top of your page, when you want to keep a neuron at rest, that means you don't want to send a nerve impulse down the neuron, and you don't want to activate neighboring cells. So if you're sleeping, for instance, you definitely want your neurons to be at rest. You don't want them to be activated, and you don't want them to be sending nerve impulses on your behalf. You want them to stay in an inactive state. So at rest, let me introduce not only sodium, but also potassium. We've talked about sodium and where it's mostly located. At rest, where is sodium mostly found?
Outside
cells, right. So it is also outside our neurons, and potassium is mostly on the insides of our neurons. Okay? You'll notice that both are cations. That means they carry what charge?
Positive.
Positive. But you may wonder why they say the outside of our cell is positive while the inside is overall negative. It has to do with relative abundance. If the majority of our cations are outside the cell, and just a few are on the inside of our cell, we're going to say we've got lots and lots outside, just a few inside. That gets really repetitive and really confusing. So they make it black and white simple. They say that where you've got the majority of your ions, you carry a positive charge. Okay? So where you have the majority of your ions, you're going to carry a positive charge. Where you have the least number of ions, you're going to carry a negative charge. Okay? So the majority is where the positive charge is located. And the least number is where you've got a negative charge. So we're looking at a charge setup here. This is an unequal distribution of charges. Therefore, we're going to call it a polarized neuron. I know you've heard the word polarity before, back when we talked about water molecules. Back then, we used it to mean that there was an unequal sharing of charge. But here, there's an unequal distribution. Nonetheless, this is what we call a polarized neuron. If you look at your sheet, there number 4 says the charge at rest is negative 70 millivolts. That's a value worth knowing. Number 4 says the overall charge at rest inside your neuron is negative 70 millivolts. That's a charge value worth knowing. So way back when we talked about active transport, I may have mentioned to you the sodium-potassium pump would revisit us again. So I'd like to reintroduce you to the sodium-potassium pump. It is a pump powered by ATP, and it's constantly collecting sodiums. You'll notice there's three on the outside, and there's two potassiums being returned to the inside. So, you know, sometimes people install sump pumps in their basement to make sure their basements don't flood with water, and they're always on. That's what a sodium-potassium pump is. It's always running, and it's always pumping out three sodiums, and it's moving in two potassiums. And because it's active transport, what must we use to power this pump?
ATP.
ATP, exactly right. Okay, so even when you're sitting here at rest, sometimes these potassiums will leak out, and the sodium-potassium pump says, not so fast, I'll take care of you. It pumps them right back in. So the potassiums are leaky. They tend to want to escape, but not so much with the sodiums. Those sodiums only get to come into your cell if we open up a sodium channel and let them in. So the potassiums must think there's a lot of fun on the outside. By the way, that's where the positive charge sits, right? Okay, so there's going to be more excitement. Those potassiums tend to leak more so than the sodiums tend to come in. Yep. Two potassiums come in, three sodiums pump out. That's right. Let me make a point about that. That sodium-potassium pump does not pump three and three. It doesn't pump two for two. It pumps three sodiums out and only two potassiums in. So if you do that, you're always going to end up with more ions sitting where?
Outside,
yeah. And that's what you want if you want to return your cell to rest. You pump all those sodiums out, and that's where the positive charge accumulates, giving you what overall value inside your cell?
Negative
70, good.
So I have a quick question.
Sure.
You said this is always running?
It's always running.
Where is it?
Sitting all along the length of your neuron. And so it's constantly making sure that the sodiums that leak in or potassiums that leak out are going to be returned to their normal locations. So if you think about a plasma membrane with its phospholipid bilayer, these are inserted along the length of your neuron.
And it's doing this
to maintain resting potential, because if you don't do that, you're going to end up depolarizing your cell, which is where we're going.
So sodium potassium is to
maintain resting? Maintain resting, yeah. Now, down at the bottom of the page is just a summary. We're going to cover that over the next three or so pages, so I wouldn't necessarily read that yet, quite yet. I'll get to that as we go through the next few pages. So let me flip you on over to page 96. Do you have questions so far about resting potential? So you know the story, right? Along comes a neurotransmitter. We'll use acetylcholine, it's familiar. Acetylcholine diffuses across a synaptic cleft. It binds a receptor on one of our sodium channels, and when it binds that receptor, those sodium channels open, and here comes those positive charged sodiums into our cell. Okay? This all familiar, right? Okay. So if you let sodium start rushing into your cell, you're now going to end up with the majority on the inside of your cell. So you can now say that instead of being negative 70 millivolts, you drop to negative 60 millivolts, negative 50, and so forth. So this influx of sodium through this open sodium channel will lead to a depolarization of your cell. Depolarization means you're making it more positive. It means you're no longer sitting at negative 70 millivolts, which is resting potential. Okay, so that's going to be what we're looking at here on this next page. On page 96, we're going to talk through depolarization and how we can create an action potential. let's hit this one more time. As long as your cell is sitting at rest, what's the charge inside? Negative 7, good. And inside you've got mostly what ions? Potassiums, right? And outside you've got mostly sodium. So at rest, that's your setup. All it takes is something like acetylcholine, some type of neurotransmitter that binds our receptor on those sodium channels. That binding of acetylcholine to the receptor will open up those channels, and now sodium say, oh, I've been dying to get on the inside, here I go. And so they start flooding from high concentration outside to low concentration inside. Okay, and so that flood of sodium's coming in is going to depolarize your cell. In other words, we're no longer sitting at a stable negative 70 millivolts. We are now dropping to a more positive value, negative 60, negative 50, negative 40. You eventually hit zero. You even go into the positive millivolt side. So that influx is going to destabilize our cell. We're saying it's depolarization. If you look at number 4 on that page with me, I want to introduce something called threshold, which is negative 55 millivolts. That's a value worth knowing. Threshold is negative 55 millivolts.
And so basically depolarization has to reach threshold to reach action potential.
Bingo. Yes. We're going to go through it. It's if you have to reach threshold to get action potential. If you don't reach threshold, you don't get action potential. Okay, so let me explain what's happening here. If you have just a few acetylcholines bind to your receptors, you may open up a few of those sodium channels, and some sodium start coming into your muscle cell or into your nerve cell, whatever it is we're talking about here. Once you have a few come flooding in, let's say that we travel from negative 70 to negative 60 millivolts. We have not reached threshold. Threshold is negative 55. Keep in mind, all the while, sodium-potassium pump is cleaning up the place. It's pumping out those sodiums and pumping back in the potassiums. So as long as you're, say, somewhere between negative 70 and negative 55, you're not going to reach threshold, and there's not going to be a nerve impulse transmitted. So sodium-potassium pump just cleans up the place and puts it back to a complete resting state. But what if you have enough sodiums flood in that you hit negative 55 and you keep moving to negative 50, negative 45, negative 40? What happens at negative 55? You're now not only depolarized, you're now going to reach action potential. Exactly. So action potential is another word for what?
Nerve impulse.
Nerve impulse. Yeah, action potential at negative 55 is achieved. That's just another word for nerve impulse. I do want to draw your attention to something there in bold, still number 4, called the all or none principle. So what this means is if you hit threshold at negative 55, you're going for it. It's all or none. That means you're going to produce an action potential if you reach negative 55. If you don't reach negative 55, it's none. Okay? So either you do it or you don't. There's nothing halfway about it. So it's either all in at negative 55 or nothing happens if you don't get there. Okay? So negative 55 is threshold. You can be depolarized, but when you reach threshold, you're now guaranteed an action potential. So when you hit negative 55 and you've reached action potential, we're going to open up these sodium channels like crazy. The excitement of opening sodium channels causes more to open, and that allows for more and more sodium to come flooding into your cell. And eventually what happens is this is going to spread along the length of your nerve impulse, and it's going to travel down along your axon to the axon terminals, and we're going to transmit it to the next neighboring cell. So once you hit threshold, it's game on. You've got the action potential that's now being conducted. Let me draw your attention to the graded potential. That is 4A. So, you know, sometimes people sit at the stoplight and they rev their engines, they're waiting for the light to turn green, and when the light turns green, they're going to slam on the gas, and there they go. And ha ha, if their car stalls out, right? Okay, so there you are, you're going along, and they're sitting back there at the stoplight, and you think, well, that's what you get, right? That's a graded potential. You thought you were going to have great excitement, and there was nothing. Okay, so graded potential means you had a little bit of sodiums come into your cell, but what didn't happen? No action potential. So you didn't reach what negative value? 55, right. Maybe you hit negative 60, but you didn't hit negative 55, and so there you sit, sputtered out. That's called a graded potential. Okay, now, if you actually did hit negative 55, that graded potential could turn into an action potential. Okay, but you got to hit that negative 55 value.
So graded potential just means you came close.
You came close, but you didn't get anywhere, yeah. Okay, let's talk about 4B. 4B says, when the stimulus changes the environment and those gates open, we're talking about sodium gates. Either sodium can rush in, causing depolarization, which may move you from negative 70 to negative 60. Maybe you're going to get to negative 55. But it can also cause potassium gates to open. Okay, so let's take a look back here again. Keep in mind, we say that wherever you've got a positive charge is where you have what? The most ions. And so if you have potassiums actually leaving your cell through potassium channels, then you're going to put more and more ions on the outside. That's going to leave you with less and less ions on the inside. And if you do that, we say you're hyperpolarizing your cell. Instead of being negative 70 millivolts, where are you heading? Higher, yeah, negative 80, negative 90, negative 100, negative 110. So we're going in the wrong direction for what?
Action
potential, right? Because action potential is the other direction. If you want to reach action potential, you've got to hit negative 55, right? So if you're hyperpolarizing, which may be the case with the graded potential, you may in fact make it more difficult for a nerve impulse to be transmitted. So these are potassium channels here, and they of course can leak too many potassiums out, and that creates an even stronger negative resting potential in your cell. Thinking big picture here, if you are a diabetic and you have insulin shots, insulin can actually increase the loss of potassium from our cells. That can hyperpolarize cells. And your heart is of course a muscle. What happens to your heart now? It gets weak. And can your heart beat strong enough to pump blood? Maybe not. So this is where we're heading with this, is we're thinking big picture and as to how does this affect your body, and that's where we're going to go with this in Bio 211. So understanding that potassium's leaking out is critical for realizing that if you lose potassium out of your cells, you're not going to be able to conduct a nerve impulse. It's going to sit there in an extremely hyperpolarized state. Hyperpolarization is very unlikely to produce what?
Action potential,
right? Because you are so far from what value?
Negative
55, exactly right. Okay, questions? Go ahead.
I'm just trying to understand. So when you said, is it like a certain amount that's supposed to be on the outside, or you just want to look at the picture and say, this has, like, how would I know? Would you have a number?
A value.
Oh, just a number?
Need a number, yeah. If I said to you I'm negative 100 millivolts, you would know off the bat I'm hyperpolarized. Yep.
Anything above negative 90 is hyperpolarized?
Actually, negative 70. Yeah, negative, because negative 70 is normal rest. So if you go beyond that toward negative 80, negative 90, so forth, now you're hyper. Yep. Okay. Hyperpolarization?
Yes.
Yeah, both the sodium and potassium are going to be on the outside. Very little of anything is going to be inside. It'd be mostly potassiums in there, but they're leaking out. For depolarization, you've got sodiums coming in. So
your sodium overtakes your potassium.
Sodium overtakes your potassium, right. And during hyperpolarization, your potassium overtakes your sodium.
Oh, okay. So with depolarization, potassium is still on the inside, but sodium is coming in with it.
With depolarization, yes. Okay, so let me hit you with the sodium potassium pump one more time, and this is going to take us over to page 97. All right, so once we're done with the nerve impulse, we're going to reset the values on the inside of our cell. We want to be polarized again after a nerve impulse has been conducted. So what charge should we have inside our cell?
Negative
70. So at the height of action potential, we may reach as strong as positive 30 millivolts. So we need to get rid of all these excess sodiums. And so that's going to be a little more difficult than what initially we might set out to think. So repolarization's job is to reset the negative 70 resting stage inside your cell. And we do that not necessarily by using the sodium potassium pump first, but we're going to do something else instead. So the whole issue here is the positive charge is located where you have the most ions. Where's the negative charge located? Where you have the least ions, right. So when you want to repolarize your cell and set it back into a resting state, then you have to allow something to leave your cell. So let me put it to you this way. If you've got a concert, and you've got a concert hall that opens at 8 p.m., and all these sodiums are on the outside, and they're excited, and they want to come in, all it takes is for you to open up that sodium channel, and they rush in and depolarize your cell. Are they going to be very interested in being invited to leave right away? They're going to say, we just got here, let us stay. So the potassiums that are on the inside say, whoa, this is too much for us, we'll leave. So we actually slowly open up these potassium channels, and these potassiums tend to leak out. So if you leak out enough potassiums, you're going to reverse the charge back to a negative 70 millivolt on the inside. So when we think of repolarization, we think of restoring the resting potential. We're returning it back to the negative 70 millivolt state. You do that by letting the potassiums leak out first. Do you see the problem we just created? You open the floodgates, you let the sodiums rush inside. They're currently sitting inside your cell. You very slowly opened up these potassium channels and they leaked out. Opposite, right? So if we tried to achieve resting state, where should sodiums actually be? Not inside.
Outside.
Outside. And the potassiums that just leaked out should be?
Inside.
So how do you get them back to their proper location? Sodium potassium pump, yeah, shift them around. You move three potassiums out, and you're right, three sodiums out, two potassiums back in. So this is all the time running. It's constantly trying to restore resting state. And so now you have to wait. You have to wait for this pump to restore these ions back to their normal locations. How long does that take? Until it gets back to normal. Yeah, until you get enough back into so that you can ensure your negative 70 resting millivolt charge inside your cell. So those who have fast motor skills have fast sodium potassium pumps. You know, some people can play the piano, they can type really quickly, they have fast motor skills, they have fast pumps. If you are not a fast typer, for instance, it may just be that your pumps are a little slower to restore that resting state. So the movement that can occur after a resting period must rely on the speed of these sodium potassium pumps. The waiting period that you're having to go through is at the very bottom of your page. It is called the refractory period. Okay, this waiting time is called the refractory period. obviously we've been doing this the hard way. We've been talking about a unmyelinated axon. It'd have been so much easier if our discussion had been for the myelinated axon. So at the very bottom, once again, if you had done this whole process along the length of a myelinated axon, you would be doing what's called saltatory conduction. So we've been doing it the hard way through an unmyelinated axon. So let's do this one more time. I'm going to map this out on the board for you. We're going to start from the beginning and do it all one more time through. And then I've got a short video that we'll walk through again. So hopefully after three times, this will start making some connections. Get those dendrites to bud, right? First things first, we've got ourselves an unmyelinated axon. How do you know?
Is it vesicle?
There was no myelin sheath. Yeah, there's no myelin sheath. This is unmyelinated. And the second thing we want to appreciate is here's our cell body, these are our dendrites, there's the axon, and the nerve impulse transmission is traveling in what direction? Away from the cell body. Yeah, A toward the axon is away from the cell body. So that's how we're going to follow our nerve impulse. There's three types of things in the plasma membrane surface that we want to pay attention to. We want to look at those sodium channels, the potassium channels, and also those sodium-potassium pumps. So let's establish resting potential. Resting potential has a negative what charge?
Negative
70. Good. Inside your cell, we should see what types of ions?
More potassium.
So. Yeah, more potassiums. And outside the cell, we should see
more sodiums.
As long as you stay negative 70 or even negative 80 or negative 90, you're going to stay at rest, and that means that there's no nerve impulse that's going to be conducted along the length of your cell. So along comes a neurotransmitter. We can talk about acetylcholine since it's familiar, and let's let acetylcholine bind one of these sodium channels. When that neurotransmitter binds the sodium channel, what happens to the state inside your cell? Yeah, it becomes more positive if we bind and open up one of those sodium channels. Okay, so let's open up that sodium channel. Let's let those sodiums come rushing in.
Okay, so
have enough sodiums rush in to move us from negative 70 to negative 60. Did we do anything?
No.
No. We didn't reach what critical value?
Threshold,
yeah, negative 55. So if that's all you did, then this is the end of the story. Your sodium-potassium pump cleans up the joint, you're done. But let's take it the next step. Let's say that we do reach negative 55. Now we see we're not only depolarized, but we're guaranteed what?
Action potential.
Action potential. And the name of that principle is? All or none. Yeah, we're going to reach that all or none. So we move from negative 55 to negative 40, negative 30, negative 20, negative 10, 0, positive 10, positive 20, positive 30. That is where you go at the height of an action potential. And this is such contagious excitement that the sodium channels down the length of your axon open up just from the excitement alone. They're voltage-gated channels. And so they respond to the excitement inside your cell. So they let sodiums in. So we just keep on going down here and let sodiums rush into your cell. The action potential travels like a wave. It travels from the point where you initiate the excitement down the entire length of your axon. So it's going to move like a twig on fire to the end of our axon. Okay? And as we move that wave of excitement, we open up sodium channels as we go. Now, coming right along behind that wave of excitement, it's going to be a wave of the cleanup crew. The cleanup crew is called repolarization. Repolarization's job is to restore us back to resting potential. So what we need to do is, now that we're ready to clean up, since this wave of action potential has passed by, what types of channels are we now going to open? Open up the potassium channels, right. So we're going to let the potassium channels open, which starts us on the pathway to repolarizing and returning us to a negative 70 millivolt charge. So let's go down here and use some of these. So restoring the resting state's repolarization, yeah, you could lose too many potassiums, and in that case, we call it hyperpolarization. Give me a value for hyperpolarized neurons. Anything greater than negative 70, negative 90 would work, negative 110 would work. So as long as you're moving in the wrong direction from threshold. So the leaking of those potassiums starts to restore our negative 70 charge. That's great. That's where we want to be if we want to send our cell back to a resting state. But uh-oh, we've got a mess because now we've got sodium stuck inside our cell. Potassiums have leaked outside our cell. What is the final step in restoring all these ions back to their normal location? Yeah, that sodium-potassium pump's going to take care of the final cleanup. So it's always running. It's always moving out. How many sodiums?
Three.
Move out three and move in?
Two.
Move in two potassiums. Good. So while you wait for that pump to work, we are in the blank period. Refractory period. Yeah, you're sitting there waiting, you're in the refractory period. I do want to mention to you a couple of terms on the bottom of, I believe it's your next page, IPSP and EPSP. They're related to what we've been talking about. I believe that's the bottom of page 98. So if you let sodiums rush in, are you more likely to depolarize or hyperpolarize your cell?
Depolarize,
right. And the fancy word for that is EPSP, which, good gosh, listen to this one. Excitatory postsynaptic potential is what that stands for. In plain English, it means you're getting ready to excite your cell. But if you're going to open up your potassium channels and you let a bunch of potassiums leak out, now what's going to happen to your charge?
Hyperpolarization.
So hyperpolarization does the other term down there, IPSP, which is an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. Basically, it makes your cell stay at rest. You've made it so very negative, it's impossible to reach threshold.
You said follow in the order of the alphabet. D and H.
That's a good way to do it, yeah. D and E, and yeah, that's a great way. Did y'all hear his hint? Let's tell him again.
It's in the same order of the alphabet. The depolarization and then the excitatory, whatever, D and E and H and I.
That's good.
Yeah.
So I figure you guys are probably comfortable with what happens at the synapse. That is at the top of the page. So we know that once we reach the end of this axon, which would be off the end of our board there, then we, of course, release vesicles full of neurotransmitter. Those vesicles diffuse into our synaptic cleft. And, of course, we start the story again when that neurotransmitter binds a receptor on the neighboring cell, opens up sodium channels, and promotes depolarization or an action potential inside that cell. Just a couple of thoughts. Is depolarization a guarantee of an action potential?
Yes.
What must you reach for it to be a guarantee?
Threshold,
yes. Yeah. So depolarization is not a guarantee of an action potential. If all you do is go from negative 70 to negative 60, there's no guarantee because you can now hit the all or none principle. Nothing is going to happen. Okay, so just want to mention that depolarization is not a guarantee of an action potential. Let me ask you this. What is more likely to produce an action potential? A depolarized cell or a hyperpolarized cell?
Depolarized.
Depolarized, right, good. Which one is closer to threshold? Depolarized? Now, they're great at potential work, didn't they? Okay. So depolarized or hyperpolarized, which one's closer to threshold?
Depolarized.
Depolarized, good. Okay, so why is threshold such an important number?
Because
it's all or not, it's going to guarantee you an action potential, right? And what's another word for action potential? Nerve impulse. Good, nerve impulse. Okay, so if I have a cell that's, say, negative 70 millivolts, you would say what about it?
Resting,
good. If I'm negative 60, you would say?
You're just sitting there. You're just so resting. You didn't reach threshold.
I'm actually depolarized, but I haven't reached what critical number?
Negative 55.
Let's say that I have a positive 10 value. You would now say?
Depolarized. You reached threshold.
I reached threshold. I must be conducting an action potential. Yeah. If I'm on the positive side of negative 55, we've gone for it. It's all or none. You're going to conduct a nerve impulse.
Okay.
Okay. Let's say we're negative 110 millivolts.
Hyperpolarized.
Good. What if you're negative 57?
Just depolarized.
You're just depolarized, yeah.
So close.
So close. What if you're negative 54? Action potential, yeah. You met threshold, action potential will occur. Nerve impulse transmission will occur. Good. If we're at, say, positive 20, what ions do I have inside the cell?
Sodium.
Yeah. And I'm very slowly opening up my leaky potassium. Good. If enough potassiums leak out of my cell, what charge will happen inside?
Negative.
Yeah, very negative. So I can start making it negative 70, or I can even send it into the hyperpolarized state. If I have a sodium potassium pump that is currently working to restore the resting potential, we say we're in what state?
Refractory
period. Good. Can you conduct another nerve impulse during that time period?
No.
You can't. You're having to wait for that action or that sodium potassium pump to restore resting state. Okay. Would you like to see the video, or do you feel mostly comfortable? We'll see it. Okay. It's a real short one. I do, and I can put those up for you too. That puzzle. Yes. Like to watch the video, it has voiceover on D2L. You have to look in the content area for animations. And of course, these are not myelinated. There is a myelin sheath there, but none of these have myelin sheaths, so the nerve impulse transmission is actually slower in an unmyelinated neuron. So here we are at resting potential on the outside of our cell. What ion is mostly on the outside?
Sodium,
good. Who's at work?
The sodium
potassium pump. See, it's moving two potassiums in. There goes your three sodiums out. And that's your ATP molecule right there. So it's constantly trying to maintain a resting state. And what type of channel lets certain ions out?
Potassium.
Yeah, those potassiums are unfortunately leaking. How do you know we're currently at rest?
Negative inside.
Yeah, negative inside, positive outside. So all it takes is a nerve impulse or a stimulus or a neurotransmitter to open up a certain type of channel. What type of channel should we open to depolarize our cell? Sodium. Yeah, open up those sodium channels. There it is. You opened up that sodium channel. Sodiums rush in. We must have reached threshold because the value inside is now positive. So this positive value tells me that we're conducting a what?
Action potential.
Action potential, right. Those potassium channels are slow, but we're going to overwhelm them with all this sodium coming in, and that's going to be enough to conduct an action potential. And there's that pump. You know, it's constantly working to restore resting potential. Okay. So once you allow for those sodium channels to open and you let the sodiums come in, there they are right there. This is our wave of action potential. It goes down the length of your axon toward the axon terminals. And the excitement is so great that it opens up your sodium channels that are further down line. It doesn't take another neurotransmitter. It just takes the excitement. Coming along behind, back here, is a wave of the cleanup crew. That is the repolarization wave. And that repolarization wave is opening up what types of channels?
Potassium.
Yeah, so there they are. They're leaking out. And what does the leakage of potassium do for our charge? Makes it go back negative. Yeah, makes it return to the negative state once again. So if you'd like to watch that one, they do have a voiceover narrator. It is on D2L in the content area. And if you'd like the answers to the puzzle, why don't I post those for you? I don't know that we have time. If y'all have any questions, let me know for Monday.